Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hello, Chris. Good to talk again. Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of The Other Hand. Had a great weekend in London, Chris. QPR beat Preston 1-0, which was really important. Was over with my two sons, had a great time. But as always is the case, I was just so struck by the vibrancy of London. It really is a city that's alive.
By sheer coincidence, Jim, I think I was a few yards from you in Soho on Saturday night. So if I'd known you were there, I would have got you to buy me a drink, but I didn't. So we'll have to wait till next time. But yeah, Soho on a Saturday night is quite something. A lot of people, a lot of energy, a lot of noise, and it's just great to pick up that vibe.
Yeah, it is. It is indeed. No. We were in a lovely cocktail bar in Soho until the early hours of the morning. So good fun. Anyway, getting back to more serious matters, I want to start off today by just talking a little bit about the Department of Finance's stability update. This is basically their up-to-date outlook for the Irish economy. Just want to give our listeners the headlines from that. The department said that there are mixed signals emerging on the Irish economy, but that on balance, the economy is in reasonable shape, at least in aggregate terms. I was struck by that wording because I think on this podcast over quite some time, I certainly have been talking about that the aggregate statistics in this country look very strong, but that if you delve beneath the surface, that it's not quite as positive as the aggregate statistics suggest. So hopefully the people in the Department of Finance are listening to the other hand, Chris. The strength in the economy is obviously the strength of the labour market. And secondly, they allude to the fact that inflation is subsiding faster than anticipated. And this is largely because aggregate demand and aggregate supply are now in better balance in the economy. On the downside, they cite some weakness in consumer spending and private investment, both of which have lost some momentum. And they attribute this to the cost of living increases, which have put a squeeze on real wages and also on higher interest rates, which have the effect, amongst other things, of increasing the real cost of capital. So that's the picture. It's a mixed enough one. Just to throw in some of these statistics they're talking about, modified domestic demand, which, as we've often explained, strips out some of the distortions created by the multinational sector and by activities such as aircraft leasing and intellectual property asset transfers, modified domestic demand up by is expected to increase by 1.9% this year. That is down slightly from their last forecast of 2.2% back in October. And that is actually largely attributable to this softness in consumer spending and indeed the private investment. I actually think that a 1.9% forecast is on the conservative side, and I certainly wouldn't be surprised to see 2.5% growth or thereabouts. At least that's my projection.
Jim, on that, I mean, do you think that the department was just erring on the side of caution overall with its tone there? Because there was definitely a tone of just saying that things have... I got the sense that they're saying that things have slowed down a bit and that they were trying to dampen expectations for growth over the next while. Do you think that's the game they were playing? And if so, do you think it was the right game to play?
Well, I think the Department of Finance is, well, in my view, is definitely erring on the conservative side, because the last thing you want in the run-up to the last budget before a general election, and it's a budget that certainly has been pointed out by both Fine Gael and particularly Michael McGrath, Fianna Fáil at the recent Fianna Fáil Ardèche, that the budget in October will be a giveaway budget. So I think the Department of Finance is very definitely dampening down expectations, or at least is trying to guide expectations in that regard. It is, and I guess where that plays true is in the public finances, and the general government balance is expected to be in surplus of 8.6 billion this year and 9.7 billion next year. That would equate to 2% of GNI star this year and 3% next year. So significant budget deficits in an election year. However, if you strip out the windfall corporation tax take, the picture is very different. And those windfall corporation taxes are estimated at 11.3 billion this year. And if you extract that, you'd be talking about a deficit of about 2.7 billion this year. And next year, they're talking about windfall corporation taxes of 11.5 billion. I have no idea where they come up with those sorts of numbers, how you quantify it. But it definitely is sending out a strong message. Listen, the economy is a little bit softer, while the public finances in aggregate look strong. But if you strip out these vulnerabilities created by the corporation tax take, well, then the underlying picture isn't quite as good. So listen, Pascal Donohoe and Michael McGrath, don't be too profligate in October with your budget. That seems to be the message.
I hear the sound of horses having bolted stable doors and all those sorts of cliches. I was talking about this in a different context with somebody this morning about what would the next generation, or perhaps the next half a generation in 10 or 15 years' time, say when they look back on this period of the last few years and the next couple of years in terms of Ireland's economy. And I think several things will come to mind. One was that we did a UK rather than a Norway with respect to our windfall revenues. The UK and Norway back in the 60s, early 70s, discovered oil off the North Sea, and the UK spent its windfall revenues from that oil discovery, and Norway saved it. And Norway now has the most amazing sovereign wealth fund. It owns a significant percentage of every single listed company in the world. It has many thousands of dollars, or whatever the Norwegian currency is, kroner, is that right?
Yeah.
Per citizen. And the UK has nothing to show, really has nothing to show for its oil revenue splurge that it indulged in. God knows where all the money went. And I think that comparing the two, if you think about Ireland's corporation tax revenues as a kind of an oil discovery, a wasting asset, in other words, one that eventually, we're not quite sure when, runs out, then I know which way people will interpret the way you spent that. And in terms of looking at how the Irish economy could have been better structured, partly and only partly with the help of those revenues, is that we look at, and we've said this before, the imbalanced nature of the Irish economy, the international sector and the domestic sector. We've relied on that international sector, most obviously for corporation tax revenues, but also for a lot of jobs and a lot of economic activity that comes with those jobs. And we have neglected the domestic economy. We've got a very bifurcated economy. And I know that you and I have discussed the moaning and groaning of the SME sector, for example, in recent times. And I've always said that, you know, these companies always moan no matter what the conditions that they face. But we both agree that there is some substance behind the complaints, the travails, if you like, of the SME sector, the regulations, the taxation, all of the different costs that they face that are administered by government. It's a real burden, and not enough resources, thinking, deep thinking has been devoted to how we nurture that sector, getting it ready for the day when it has to take over as the engine of growth for the Irish economy. Once the international sector, rather than being a tailwind for the Irish economy, becomes a headwind, because one day it will. It may be years in the future, we all hope it is. But one day this golden goose will stop laying the eggs and we'll be looking back and saying, why didn't we do more for the domestic Irish economic scene? Is that a reasonable soundbite, do you think, Jim?
Yeah, it is, Chris. But I would add to that, there was a survey reported in Ireland on Wednesday morning, at least in the media, saying that Ireland as a location for foreign workers to work is falling down the pecking order. And I think it's number 36 now in the global league. At least that's my interpretation of that survey. And housing, the cost and availability of housing, either to buy or to rent, is regarded as one of the big impediments to coming to Ireland to work. And no surprises there whatsoever. And you know, you look at these surpluses that are being run in the economy at the moment. To me, it's incumbent on those surpluses to be used. I totally agree with you. Try and make the whole ecosystem for the SME sector a lot more conducive to sustainability and growth. But I also think there is a big housing argument here, because in my view, and I've said it many, many times, socially, economically, politically, housing is the biggest issue. And even today, we got reports from a human rights agency saying, lamenting Ireland's housing crisis at the moment. And that's in the context of asylum seekers and refugees. Okay, the point is, it's obvious to anybody now that housing is a massive problem. It is a massive impediment to the future growth and sustainability of the economy. So those surpluses, at least large parts of those surpluses, in my view, should be used to address the housing crisis in a meaningful way. And I can hear people say, well, listen, we don't have the capacity to go from 32,000 housing residential unit completions last year to the sort of 50,000 per annum that we need as soon as possible, that we don't have the capacity to do that. Okay, I can hear that being argued at the moment. But I mentioned in the last podcast that I had a long and meaningful conversation with the CEO of one of our biggest construction companies very recently, who said to me that he does not believe that there is a constraint in terms of capacity, that he could move a lot of workers out of office development into residential if the environment for the delivery of residential was more conducive. So in other words, if the whole planning process and the whole regulatory environment for the delivery of housing was actually freed up, he would have the workers to deliver houses. And he assures me that most other big construction companies are the same at the moment. And when you think about, you know, what a lot of those workers were moved out of residential into office development, particularly in recent years. But you look at the future for office development here in Dublin and indeed around the country, with the changes to work practices from people working at home. And there is obviously quite a bit of vacant office space around Dublin at the moment. So it would make sense to actually reallocate workers away from office development tours where it's really needed. So, Chris, that more than anything else is what I would do with those surpluses, because that would be an investment in the long-term sustainability of the economy. And, you know, I go back to the point, and I agree with you about nurturing the environment and the ecosystem for the SME sector, but also I think by addressing housing, you would make the multinational sector more sustainable in this country, because housing is one of the biggest issues, not the only one, but it is one of the biggest issues. So that is what I would be doing with the surpluses. But do we have a politician in the Dáil that actually has that sort of vision at the moment? I mentioned to you in a conversation yesterday that I was presenting a report I co-authored in Amber in Trinity yesterday, and I shared the stage with Mary Harney, amongst others. I was a huge admirer of Mary Harney as a politician. Okay, I think she was 34 years a TD, the longest serving female politician ever in the country, as far as I know. And just sitting back, listening to her yesterday, agree or disagree, but here was a, well, I would happen to agree, actually, but here is a politician that, you know, has a vision. And I think the political system today just totally lacks that.
Jim, can I read you out something?
Yes.
The acute shortage of housing, particularly social and genuinely affordable housing, has led to spiralling rents and house prices across the country. Many young people and families on low to middle incomes struggle to afford to rent or buy a decent home. Overcrowding, evictions, rent arrears and homelessness are all on the rise. We are concerned about the lack of appropriate government funding to invest in social rented homes, the lack of skills or capacity in council housing departments to build new homes, the dramatic reduction in the supply of social and genuinely affordable housing through various policies. There are 1.1 million households on social housing waiting lists, the impact of austerity and cuts to housing services and jobs, the lack of effective regulation in the private rented sector, the high cost of renting and home ownership, the poor quality of some homes in both the social and the private rented sector, and how this affects the well-being of tenants, and the effects of housing benefit cuts on vulnerable people who struggle to meet their housing costs. We're calling on the government to take urgent action to invest in a national house building program. Guess what country I'm talking about, Jim?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's obviously not Ireland.
Why not?
Well, it is Ireland, but you wouldn't be reading it out if it was Ireland. It's the UK.
It's the UK, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just from one of the many documents that say things like that. And I go back to my thing that I always say, Jim, is that this problem is a big one. It's global. It's in many, many countries. And it's going to take very deep thinking, brave action, and an awful lot of money to solve. And I'm not sure that our political systems are up to it. I mean, they clearly haven't been up to it. And the fact that it is a global phenomenon, tells us something about how hard it is. Not impossible, but just how hard it is going to be to solve. And I must say, I'm both in the UK and in Ireland, I'm not that optimistic. Because at the very least, the only way you're going to be able to solve this by doing all of the things that you need to do to solve it, it's going to take years, years and years. And I don't think that we have politicians who have that kind of time horizon. We as an electorate, Jim, we don't give them the time horizon, do we?
No, we do not, actually. No. The electoral system, particularly, I think, in this country, is very, very short term in its nature. There's no doubt about that. And the diluted form of democracy we have here definitely guarantees that. But also, as you say, there's two sides to the coin. The other side is the fact that we as an electorate get what we vote for. You know, that is the reality. But and what it actually takes is a politician that is prepared to take a long-term vision and strategy of what they want the economy and the country and society to look like, and do everything in their power to actually deliver that. And I go back to, I mentioned Mary Harney as one of those politicians in my view. Alan Dukes, for example, the TALA strategy back in 1987 was a fundamental change in the Irish political system and how it works. It was very effective in terms of turning the Irish economy around at that stage, but it cost Alan Dukes ultimately the leadership of Fine Gael, okay, because the electorate didn't like it, and particularly his own party. You look at somebody like Ray McSharry back in 1987, who became the Minister for Finance, Mac Donifas, as he was known, you know, he had a vision as well. So throughout Don O'Malley, who introduced free second level education, people like that, politicians like that, you know, had a vision, and they were prepared to take a slightly longer term perspective on the policy initiatives they're implementing. You could say, I'll probably get eaten for saying this, you could say Charlie Haughey also, as flawed as he was, he also had some vision, and the IFSC Temple Bar were examples of that, and people can lament what Temple Bar, or indeed the IFSC, looks like today. But if you think back to what they looked like 20, 30 years ago, by God, have we made progress.
I remember when you and I moved into the IFSC, Jim, there was a pub just across the road from our brand new office block that was a classic north inner city Dublin pub. And the day we moved in, a sign went up in the window, no suits.
No suits, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, that was a day. Can I offer two thoughts on what you've just said? I could obviously talk about it all day, but I promise you I won't. The main one is this. I have a theory about house prices that I don't think that we may be able to solve the housing shortage and get rid of queues around the block when new housing developments come on and all that sort of thing, and maybe stop house prices from going up in the way that they have done, maybe put a little bit of downward pressure on rents. But I don't think we're ever going back to the affordable houses that that perhaps we, when we were much younger, and certainly our parents' generation, both in the UK and in Ireland, were faced with. And that's because I think house prices in the past were the wrong price. This is my theory of the day. And that they were a bit like equities 50, 60, 70 years ago. People look at stock markets and wonder why they've had such a brilliant half century. And there are lots of reasons for that. Economic growth and the fact that so many companies have been formed and so much progress has been made, absolutely. But the fact is they were also the wrong price 50 or 60 years ago because we didn't know how to value them properly. We know how to value these assets much better than we did in the past. It's not perfect. Our techniques are not absolutely perfect. But I suspect that what we've experienced, one driver of higher house prices over the last while, is that they reached the level that they should always have been at. If you think about them in textbook financial spreadsheet terms about how you value assets. And so I think that the only thing really that will ever get house prices way down again is if we go back to the conditions that obtained when they were very cheap in Dublin. And that was when there was good old-fashioned economic weakness, recessions. And people were leaving the country because they couldn't get jobs and all that sort of thing. So I'm quite pessimistic about getting house prices down in any meaningful way. We can do a lot about supply, but I'm not convinced that we're going to get big, real terms falls in either house prices or rents going forward, provided the economy stays reasonably okay. But Jim, that's enough about housing for today. We'll return to it many times, no doubt, as we always do. But there's been some important economic data for at least around Europe and including the UK over the last while. Could you take us through that, please?
Lots of stuff over the last few days. The Purchasing Managers' Index, and I explain again, I think it's worth pointing out every time, that this Purchasing Managers' Index is a diffusion index, meaning that a reading over 50 means that more businesses expect to expand than contract. A reading below 50 means more companies are expecting to contract rather than expand. Okay, so the composite PMI for the euro area jumped from 50.3 to 51.4, which is another reasonably strong recovery. And within that, services very strong, 51.5 up to 52.9. But even in manufacturing, which has been obviously hit by what's going on in China, but even the manufacturing PMI went from 47.1 to 47.3. In Germany, the composite increased from 47.7 to 50.5. And indeed, this morning we got the IFO business sentiment survey for Germany, which shows another improvement in German business sentiment. It has now reached an 11-month high. I wouldn't get carried away about that because it was coming from a very low base and it's been very weak over the last 12 months. But another part of the recovery story. And indeed, in the UK, we got the composite PMI jump from 52.8 to 54, with the services sector up from 53.1 to 54.9, and that's an 11-month high. Manufacturing actually in the UK went from 50.9 to 49.1, so it went from expansion into contraction mode. I'm not sure what's driving that. I assume it's this China effect as well. And in the United States today, we got durable goods orders up by 2.6%. This is orders for manufactured durable goods. Okay, and very, very strong growth there. So there again, you have the US growth story continuing to send out very, very strong signals. And reflecting that, we see bond yields, the 10-year bond yield in the States, continuing to edge up, and 5% would certainly appear to be a realistic target at some stage in the near future. I think it's about 4.65 at the moment, but it's steadily climbing in that direction. And I see that the 30-year fixed rate mortgage in the States has just jumped to a 5-month high of 7.24%. So anyway, Chris, a lot of statistics there, but in a nutshell, what they are showing us is something that we have spoken about, I think, since last November. There is a global recovery story continuing to build and gather momentum.
Yeah, at the IMF we spoke about last time, there's been much more detail since we chatted about their preliminary release of forecasts. The head of the IMF has been doing the rounds of the various talk shows and think tanks. And the headline in today's FT, that a very long read, which says, is the global economy stumbling into the tepid 20s? What that refers to is that the IMF has become more optimistic in the short term on the basis of all the data that you and I have been talking about for months now, and has come round to the other hand's point of view, which is that global growth led by the US is a good bit stronger than they previously thought. We used to obsess about hard landings, soft landings. It doesn't look like there's going to be any landing at all. We always thought that those talk about landings was nonsense anyway. But the tepid 20s is a forecast, a longer term, medium term forecast made by the IMF for very subdued growth beyond this pickup that they are observing at the moment. And as they say, they call it the tepid 20s. And what lies behind the gloom, according to the FT, is a mixture of weak productivity, retrenchment in globalization, and the frequent bouts of geopolitical turmoil that you and I also have been talking about. And it says that this toxic combination is going to drag growth down to paltry levels, and in so doing, sow the seeds of popular discontent with mainstream politics. I'd argue that they're looking backwards there, and that's exactly why we do have popular discontent with mainstream politics, but they are looking forward rather than backwards. And so they think that the trend is bad, that trend growth over the next 5 years, notwithstanding that pickup in the short term, is going to be very poor. The fund's pessimism is built around a view that years of low interest rates following the great financial crisis led to a misallocation of capital that has kept inefficient zombie companies in business and stopped investment being deployed into more promising and profitable activities. And so they're very pessimistic going forward about the possibility of productivity growth. All of that sounds very plausible. it's intuitively obvious. I think it accords with a lot of people's prior beliefs, and it's very hard to see why the fund would be wrong. I'd say two things about that. One, the fund often is wrong, and so something will come along to change that picture. I do believe these sorts of things produced by the AMF in good faith, and they're very smart people doing very tricky things. I do think they are quite a good contrary indicator. So I'm going to take the other side of the bet. I think the next 5 years are going to be much better than people think. And actually, I'll take the other side of the short-term bet as well. I think that we're reaching, not quite there yet, reaching peak optimism about the short-term outlook, and that something will come along to boost that productivity story in particular, the global growth story in general. My favorite is AI. There are teething problems with it all over the place. But some of the AI systems that I've been playing with recently, away from ChatGPT, but not that one, I'm quite disenchanted with that, actually. But some of them are just truly astonishing and making such great strides. I do think that we are going to get, and probably starting to see already, a productivity boost from AI. If it isn't that, it's going to be something else, would be my view. So I'm on the other side of the IMF in both their short and their long-term forecasts.
Chris, the final point, we were talking about the budget surplus in Ireland and what might be done with it. If you go to the UK, Jeremy Hunt has said recently that he's still pushing towards tax cuts if he gets another budget ahead of an election. But the latest public finances for the UK don't exactly support that perspective. We got the 2023-24 fiscal outturn because the fiscal year in the UK runs to the 31st of March. But the
April the 5th, actually.
Oh, April 5th. I beg your pardon. Okay.
Sorry, I'm just being pedantic.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right, actually. The budget deficit came in at £120.7 billion sterling. That's £6.6 billion higher than the Office for Budget Responsibility had predicted, and it's equivalent to a budget deficit of 4.4% of GDP, and the public sector debt to GDP ratio has jumped to 98.3. That was 85.2 before COVID. So the public finance situation in the UK certainly would militate against giveaway fiscal policy anytime soon. Does it matter?
Well, it does, because they also announced yesterday a big increase in defence spending, and that goes with all of those geopolitical things that I mentioned there and that you and I have talked about a lot. And a lot of countries are going to have to increase their defence spending. The peace dividend is over. That is actually one reason to worry about global growth going forward, is that a lot of the growth boost that we saw following the fall of the Berlin Wall at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, was because so much public finances were freed up from no longer having to build so many planes, bombs and tanks. And that's all going into reverse. And that is a serious concern. The point about the UK's fiscal position and its announcement of more military spending is that it was all completely bogus. And it's part of a piece. A more broader point to make is that all of the talk about finances in the UK, public sector finances, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all hokum. They haven't got the money to build any more tanks, bombs and guns. And they say they're not going to borrow it. They're not going to raise taxes. It's all fully funded. They used an expression that you would know, Jim. It's all fully costed. And it was just rubbish. It was just rubbish. They haven't got the money. The increase in spending that they announced wasn't that big a deal. And to the extent that it was, they say it's going to be funded by rationalizing the civil service. As far as I can tell, on the UK's current spending plans, for them to retain any credibility, they're going to have to sack every single civil servant and still have to borrow some more money, because there aren't enough civil servants there to sack. There aren't enough salaries to save. So it's just a rubbish debate here in the UK, the public finances one. At least you have a decent debate about proper numbers in Ireland. We're not even doing that here in the UK.
Okay. Listen, Chris, good to talk again. I look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise, Jim. Cheers.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.